headlines, Iran says it will provide the European Union with its latest conclusion on the talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal by midnight on Monday. Israeli forces shoot to death a Palestinian man during a raid on his home in the north of Al-Quds. And China carries out new military drills near Taiwan aimed at mounting tensions over U.S. congressional delegation's visit to the island. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran will provide the European Union with its final conclusion on the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear agreement by midnight local time. That is 19:30 GMT.
I think that by 12 o'clock tonight, we will submit our final conclusion on the remaining issues between us in writing to the European Union coordinator.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Iran sees no obstacle to a revived deal if its red lines are respected. The top diplomat added that Washington must show flexibility and a realistic approach if it wants to restore the nuclear accord known as the JCPOA. Amir Abdullahian said it would not be the end of the world if the U.S. fails to do so. He warned that Iran has its own plan B if the JCPOA revival talks fail.
They talk about Plan B. We also have our own Plan B, but we believe that in the end, this matter should be resolved with the realistic approach of all parties through negotiations.
The Iranian foreign minister made these comments a week after the EU put forward what it called the final text of the JCPOA revival, following 4 days of indirect talks between the U.S. and Iran in the Austrian capital. The JCPOA was thrown into chaos after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Remaining parties to the accord have held several rounds of negotiations to restore the deal since last year. Iran's foreign ministry has reacted to the recent stabbing attack on Salman Rushdie, saying that the anti-Islam writer and his supporters should be blamed for the incident.
We don't see anyone but himself and his supporters worthy of reproach and even condemnation. Salman Rushdie exposed himself to popular anger and rage by insulting Islamic sanctities and crossing red lines of over 1.5 billion Muslims as well as followers of all divine religions.
The spokesman Kanani also categorically denied any link between Iran and the attacker. He said nobody has the right to accuse Iran in this regard. Rushdie, who authored a hugely controversial book against Islam in the 1980s, was stabbed in a public appearance in the U.S. state of New York on Friday. The attacker is in custody and has been formally charged with attempted murder in the second degree. Mohsen Abbas says Salman Rushdie was a tool in the hands of the West to confront Islam.
On an individual level, he'd kind of outlived his usefulness. I guess Rushdie takes the inauspicious honor or denigration of being, the first potential tool of Western neoliberal deep state in that process of its war on Islam, the real Islam which talks about justice and talks about governments which should be just and talks about a system which is, you know, anti-usurious perhaps, anti-corruption, anti-exploitation of the masses.
A Palestinian man has been killed in yet another Israeli operation in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces shot Mohammed al-Shaham in the head during a raid on his house in the town of Kafr Aqab, north of Al-Quds. The resistance movement Hamas has strongly condemned the aggression, saying that this confirms the extent of terrorism rooted in the regime's occupation policy. It noted, however, that such crimes will further intensify Palestinians' resistance. Meanwhile, people in the town of Qalandia in occupied Al-Quds closed their shops to mourn Shaham's death. Israel has carried out raids on almost a daily basis across the occupied territories over the past months. Our correspondent Mona Kendall has given us more details about the killing of a Palestinian young man near Al-Quds.
This time, Israeli forces and police undercover units raided the town of Kfar Aqab. It's East Al-Quds, one of the East Al-Quds towns, northern Jerusalem, Al-Quds. And in order, as usual, to conduct arrests. This is what the Israelis claim. But according to the family of this young Palestinian, Mohammed al-Shahan, it's an assassination because they raided the house of al-Shahan family, and when family members left their rooms, they were sleeping, of course. It was around 4 or 5 a.m. in the morning. They left their rooms when they were surprised by the Israeli soldiers in their house. They immediately tried to return back to escape or something like this. They were surprised. But immediately, Israeli forces shot in the head Mohammed Shaham directly without doing anything. So the family members and his father specifically is accusing the Israeli forces for assassinating his son. It was not an arrest campaign or an arrest operation because they didn't order him to, let's say, obey the orders or arrest him, or there were clashes between the Palestinians and the Israeli forces.
Several people have been injured in a shooting in the occupied East Al-Quds. The gunman targeted passengers on a bus and in a nearby car. The police have not ruled out the possibility of more than one shooter. In the meantime, Palestinian resistance groups have called the attack a heroic move.
The attack, which occurred just outside one of the gates of the occupied old city of Al-Quds on early Sunday, left at least 9 Israeli settlers injured, 2 of whom are in serious condition. Reports indicate that at least one person ambushed a bus as it arrived at the western wall in the old city. Witnesses say that as people were boarding the bus, they heard gunshots, screams, and warnings that this was an attack. The bus driver has told Israeli media that he tried to pull away, but was unable to do so. Since then, Israeli troops have been raiding homes in a Palestinian neighborhood, and reports have emerged that several suspects were involved and that some were even arrested. Palestinian resistance groups have described the attack as a natural response to the occupying Israeli regime's daily crimes against the Palestinians, calling it a heroic act. The world, however, has remained silent when atrocities against Palestinians occur, which is on a daily basis. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights reports daily killings, detainments, and other Palestinian violations, which is described as a slow death and genocide against Palestinians. But those killings don't even get reported. This attack took place in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli troops have been stationed in large numbers. But doesn't the fact that it took place there mean that Israel is failing to prevent these attacks from occurring?
Well, the first thing to understand in the conflicts that we see developing is that the Israelis, of course, are the responsible party for a lot of the antagonism and the aggression and the attacks that are constantly erupting in Al-Quds, in the Palestinian territories, because they are constantly waging a program of genocide and attempting to remove all ethnic natural inhabitants of the lands and replace them with Israeli settlers. So what the Palestinians and other people do in these areas that are being subjected to forced extermination and relocation is the same thing that any free people would do. If anyone, including myself, was forced to leave my home or evicted or lost loved ones and experienced such a horrific program of expulsion that the Israelis daily practice, of course people would be responding with any kind of militant response that they possibly could.
The shooting comes a week after a ceasefire was agreed between Israeli and Palestinian Islamic Jihad in the Gaza Strip. The truce followed 3 days of Israeli airstrikes that killed almost 50 people, including 17 children. The Islamic Jihad was clear about the response, saying that the occupying regime kills Palestinians on a daily basis and must pay the price for its crimes.
Last week, Israel carried out its latest round of aggression against the Palestinian people under the pretext that it was thwarting a terror attack by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Despite the Israeli atrocity, Palestinians did strike a ceasefire deal with the regime. But the truce is widely believed to be fragile in some sense, as the Palestinians did stop their retaliatory attacks, but Israel has yet to heed their demands. All this, along with the long list of previous Israeli attacks and atrocities against Palestinians, has led to an atmosphere of tension and frustration in the occupied Al-Quds. While the US and Europe condemn the attack, they're encouraging Ukrainians to resist the Russian war, even calling for armed resistance against Russian forces. This shows the double standard approach they have towards Palestinians. But the latest Israeli attack is only one in a long list of the regime's atrocities against the Palestinians on a daily basis. From the destruction of their homes to false imprisonment and the murder of innocent people, including women and children. All this has led to widespread anger among Palestinians whose rights have been violated, leading them to take action themselves. But the question remains, will attacks similar to the bus incident increase since the Israeli violations against Palestinians will continue?
Well, the only way that the crimes against the Palestinians that the Israelis are perpetuating will end, will stop, is when the Israeli government, the Israeli people, rise up and tell their government, we cannot survive the counterattacks any longer. We cannot endure the pain and the suffering that is being inflicted upon us. So we are demanding that the government be overthrown, replaced with new leadership that will honestly and authentically seek out peaceful negotiations of peaceful coexistence that take into account a lot of the crimes and violations of treaties that have occurred in the past, but that are dedicated to moving forward in a positive, mutually agreeable way. So the Israelis and the Israeli people really are the ones that have to suffer and before they recognize that their own government, their own military are perpetuating the suffering of the Israeli people, because the Palestinians are never going to relent. They're never going to stop fighting for their lives, fighting for their children, and fighting for their homes.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemns the latest deadly strikes by Israel against Syria. Hamas says the strikes come shortly after Israel's other violations in the occupied territories and against the Gaza Strip. The movement says regional nations should stand up to the regime and end such crimes. This comes after the Israeli military hit areas near the Syrian capital Damascus and in Tartus, which lies on the Mediterranean coast. The attack killed 3 people and injured 3 others. Syrian air defenses reportedly intercepted some of the incoming missiles over Tartus. Our correspondent in Damascus, Muhammad Ali, gives us a wider picture on the reaction to Israel's deadly strikes in Tartus.
Almost every time there is an attack, the Syrian Foreign Ministry sends letters to the United Nations Secretary General and Security Council calling on the international body to take action, to condemn such attacks, to shoulder its responsibility in preserving international peace and security. But up till this moment, we've seen no action taken against such attacks by Israel, despite the fact that those attacks do not just undermine Syria's sovereignty, but they kill sometimes civilians, and also they threaten the, of course, and endanger not just civilians in Syria, but by using Lebanese airspace, also they threaten civilian flights over Damascus and Lebanon. Despite all of those issues, there is still international silence over such attacks.
China's defense ministry says an ongoing visit by a group of American lawmakers to Taiwan fully exposes the United States' face as a troublemaker and saboteur of peace. The ministry says Beijing will smash any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. The Chinese embassy in the U.S. also echoed those warnings. It said China opposes any kind of official ties between Washington and Taipei. The mission said the U.S. has spared no effort to stir up confrontation between China and Taiwan. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said the visit is a blatant violation of the One China principle.
Realizing China's reunification is an unstoppable historical event and an indestructible consensus of the Chinese people, China once again urges the U.S. to abide by the One China principle and the three Sino-U.S. joint communiques, handle Taiwan-related issues prudently and properly, and stop going further down the wrong path of hollowing out and distorting the One China principle, so as not to cause further damage to China-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
A spokesperson added that a small number of U.S. politicians are colluding with Taiwan's separatist forces. He said they are unaware of their limits and their efforts are doomed to failure. The bipartisan U.S. congressional delegation met with a Taiwanese president on Monday. The trip comes just days after a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taipei. That triggered an angry reaction from China. Beijing imposed sanctions on Pelosi and launched its biggest ever military drills around Taiwan. China claims the island as its own territory. It launched fresh military drills near Taiwan on Monday. The military says the exercises are a stern deterrent to the U.S. and its political games undermining regional peace.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
under the starry sky of the desert. From the very heart of evergreen forests. With the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains. Closer. Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
Today, I'm going to watch a polo game. Oh God, it would be a new attractive experience. I've never seen such a game before. Tell you something. What made me decide to have a visit to a polo game today was my recent visit of an art museum in Tehran. There, I saw some stunning antique Persian miniature paintings depicting polo players. Oh, they were amazing. You can't believe it. Well, I have to rush. Not much time left to the beginning of the game. And the traffic is heavy as always. Polo or Chogan was formed in Iran around 600 BC and was played during the Achaemenid era. Polo became popular in India during the reign of Darius I. It was also part of the game culture of the Sasanid era. Renowned Iranian poets including Rudaki, Ferdowsi, Sa'di, Hafez, Nasser Khosrow, and Maulana have mentioned polo in their poetry several times. Polo flourished during the Safavid era. Historical documents show that Shah Abbas played polo and even he played polo in Qazvin, the second capital of Iran. In Isfahan, Naqsh-e-Jahan Square was also built for polo. The Europeans became acquainted with the game during the Safavid era and their colonization in India. Okay, here it is. Perfect complex for practicing polo in Tehran. It's big and equipped.
And you can't believe how many people have gathered here to watch the game. On my right, the horsemen or the players are coming out of the stable with their horses, preparing for the game. Well, I think this sport is much different from other sports or games because there should be a harmony between one part, which is human, with the other member of the team, which is an animal, a horse. There are two teams in the field. Amazing! I really can't describe the excitement of the game. Some of the spectators are using cameras to watch the game better. I wish I had one. Each team consists of four players, each using mallets with long, flexible handles to drive a wooden ball down a grass field. An exciting experience.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. We should not think that the test of Karbala was an easy test. That would be a disservice to us, ourselves, to tell us that, oh, it was just a walk in the park. They did the right thing. They saw the imam. No, it was an incredible test. The one thing that we can say about the companions is this. Their faith was incredibly strong. The faith that they had that enabled them to pass that test had some conditions. The first condition is that we have to have what's called intellectual conviction. Question, is intellectual conviction, is that enough? That once you have that, then definitely you're in the camp of Imam Hussein. Now you can go, now you can fight. Actually, no. I want to tell you a story about one of the companions of Imam Hussein. You can look him up later. Dhahak bin Abdullah. Dhahak bin Abdullah. Dhahak bin Abdullah, brothers and sisters, is one of the people who narrated the advents of Karbala for us. He was there in the tent. His story is that he came, he met the Imam asked him for help, and from the beginning, the hawk said, I've got a condition. I don't know if we're going to win this one. I've got a condition. He said that I will fight for you as long as I am beneficial for you. And the Imam accepted. The Imam's trying to save everybody. He brought the hawk in. The hawk was there when they started the battle. He was there, and then the numbers of the companions started to get reduced. The hawk says this, I noticed the enemy was deliberately trying to hamstring the horses of the Imam. He said that I went and I took my horse and I put him in one of the tents. The numbers got to reduce. He describes this. He says, I was out there, I was fighting, the Imam was praying for me, I was in Karbala, I was killing people, the Imam was making dua, encouraging me, fight. He says, until I notice the numbers start to get reduced, there's only a few of us left, we're not going to make it. He said, I told the Imam, we had a deal. The Imam said, a deal is a deal. The Imam said, how are you going to escape now? And this man was so shameless. He told the Imam, he said, well, I hid my horse in one of the tents. The Imam said, it's halal for you, go. The hawk went, got his horse, and ran out of Karbala. They chased him, he made it, he survived. He's one of the people who told us this story. So brothers and sisters, just having intellectual conviction, being certain Imam Ali is the first Imam, knowing, even going to the field of Karbala, that's not a guarantee. What else do we need? There are other conditions when it comes to faith in Islam. Needed conditions in order for us to have this faith, which is Ashura'i. The second condition that we have to have is the condition of acting on what we know. We're supposed to act on what we know. This is how Islam is separate from other religions. In Islam, it's not just mental acrobatics. It's not just believe and then you're saved. It's not like our Christian brothers and sisters who say that if you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, then you're saved. We don't say as believers, Imam Hussein died so I can live the life of Yazid. Rather, there's expectations that come with faith. If I've been intellectually convinced, if I believe this is God's book, then after that, there are certain things that Allah wants me to do. Islam is very clear about that. What are those things that Islam wants me to do? In some of the verses of Quran, Allah just prints out the principle that obey Allah and the messenger in kuntum mu'mineen. Obey Allah and the messenger if you are believers. Obedience is expected to be part of that faith. Someone who knows has to act. Someone who's understood, this is what Islam says, the expectation is that I will act on those things that I'm taught. Remember, brothers and sisters, these are building blocks. We're trying to go somewhere. We want to be in a different place after these majalis than we are when we first came. In order to do that, we've got to understand where we're going without skipping steps. In Islam, if you know you're expected to act, there's no free pass. There's no getting around it. God expects us to act on what we know. The idea is in Islam that once I know, remember those things I mentioned before, God is my creator. He's the legislator. He knows me. He receives no benefit from the laws that he makes. I'm the one who receives benefits. God is wise. If those things, those building blocks are there, the natural expectation is that now I'm going to act. But you see, there's something else too. Even just having the intellectual conviction, even just knowing that I'm going to act, is that enough to make my faith Ashura'i, to be able to pass the ultimate test? Unfortunately, no. There's another condition. This condition is what separates the men from the boys. This will help us to recognize, am I a ritualist Muslim? Or I'm a Muslim who's moving at least in the direction of Imam Hussein. If I don't have this, the ayat of the Quran, I'm not a mu'min. I'm not a mu'min. Let me give you a little bit about that. But let me explain what it is first and then show you the words of Imam Hussein. So what happened to us, in order for me to be a real Muslim, Islam is a package deal. I don't get to pick and choose with Islam. I don't get to have my favorite parts of Islam. All of Islam. Whatever God says, however God says it, that is what's required for me as a Muslim. 3 days before the Imam began his journey, he spoke to his companions. He gathered them and gave a short khutbah. The Imam said this, Alhamdulillah, wa ma sha'a Allah, wa la quwwata illa billah. And then he wrote, and we've heard this, he said that death is written for the children of Adam like the necklace on the neck of a young girl. And he explained how he longed to meet his forefathers. And he told them, he said, it's as if I see my flesh being ripped apart by those wolves over in that place called Karbala. He explained how he was pleased with Allah's decree. And then he said something that you and I, as people who are waiting for the Imam, we have to hear. He said this, Man kana badhilan fina muhjatahu. Whoever is ready to give their blood in our way. And you and I, let's think about this. Because we're waiting for a living Imam. Are we waiting for that knock on the door where the Imam calls and then suddenly my job, what I was doing, my family, my friends, all of that is out the door. Everything is what the Imam wants. Take my life. The Imam said, whoever is ready to have his blood shed in our way and has mentally prepared themselves to meet God, this person should leave with us. He said, I'm leaving tomorrow morning. There wasn't any time for the believers even to think about it, to understand what's happening. Everything is right now. The Imam expects us to be ready to leave everything and sacrifice everything at the drop of a hat. Now, brothers and sisters, that's the end of my part that I want to share today. But I want to talk a little bit before we go to the Masaib about the second and very important part of the program. The important part of the program, brothers and sisters, is in addition to us getting the intellectual content, to make sure that emotionally our hearts are ready to serve the cause. The effect of the tears for the Ahlul Bayt have been underestimated. What they do for us spiritually, coming, gathering, crying, being around with others, the effect that they have for us is incredible. This is what Imam Sadiq says about this. He says, Innahu la yara man yabki. Imam Hussein sees whoever cries for him. If you have the tawfiq of crying for Imam Hussein, the Imam says this, Fayastaghfirullah. The Imam, meaning Imam Hussein, will make istighfar for you, out of rahmah for you. And then after that, Imam Hussein is generous. He doesn't just make istighfar for you, he calls on his forefathers to also pray for you.
I swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The latest Israeli regime deadly bombardments of the Gaza Strip was accompanied by a familiar pattern in the political rhetoric of Western regimes, which have again proclaimed their solidarity with the colonizer. We now present you an article written by Denijel Djedjic, a writer and researcher currently based in Beirut, Lebanon, who holds a PhD in American Studies. The piece is titled, How the Deeply Concerned European Union Facilitates Israeli Violence. As the Israeli regime carried out its latest deadly bombardments of the Gaza Strip, Western officials have reiterated their support for the colony's atrocities against Palestinians. The European Union recycled their usual statements of alleged concern. While claiming to be troubled by the escalation in Gaza, the European Union has ardently defended the Israeli regime and has long promoted Zionist rhetoric through its own political communication. The Israeli regime's most recent bombardment campaign against the besieged Palestinian population in Gaza has caused more deaths and more destruction. Until a ceasefire came into effect on Sunday night, 7th of August, the Israeli regime had assassinated leaders of the Palestinian Resistance Group, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, and martyred at least 47 Palestinians, among them 16 children. More than 300 Palestinians were injured. No Israeli was killed. Palestinian resistance has reacted by launching rockets in retaliation into the occupied territories. The Gaza Strip has been under a blockade imposed by the Israeli regime for 15 years. Yet, while the nuclear-armed regime uses highly sophisticated weapons to bombard the people of the Gaza Strip in a densely populated de facto open-air prison, in much of Western political discourse, the victims are being blamed for resisting. The latest attack was accompanied by a familiar pattern in the political rhetoric of Western regimes, which have again proclaimed their solidarity with the colonizer. While the United States of America and the United Kingdom openly declared their outright support for their Israeli ally, the European Union has followed a more twisted approach in its political communication strategy. For years, European Union officials have been copying the same keywords and phrases from their colonial archive, rhetorically distorting the situation in Palestine in favor of Zionist myths. While alleging concern over the situation in Palestine, European Union officials have provided euphemisms and justifications for the crimes perpetrated by the Israeli regime. This was exemplified by the message conveyed by the EU's Special Representative for what the EU refers to as the West Asia peace process, Sven Koopmans. Sven Koopmans claimed he was deeply troubled by the deaths and dangerous escalation of violence in and around the Gaza Strip. The evocation of alleged emotions has long been a standard introduction to official EU statements on Palestine. However, this voicing of concern is usually accompanied by a whitewashing of the brutality of Israeli violence and an equation of the unequal power relations between the aggressor and the victim. Thus, Sven Koopmans added that all need to show maximum restraint. Broader conflict, terror and bombs disastrously affect civilians in both Gaza and Israel. The application of the conflict frame helps to present the situation in Palestine as a war between two sides. Who caused the deaths and so-called escalation remains unclear, as the European Union fails to identify the perpetrator of violence. The EU's Special Representative for West Asia Peace Process, Sven Koopmans, further claimed there was clear need for a sustainable situation in Gaza and a perspective for peace. While the European Union has invested considerable rhetoric into the myth of the so-called peace process, the Israeli regime has significantly expanded its colonial violence. Peace in the European Union lexicon implies peace for the settler community and demands that indigenous people living under occupation guarantee the safety of their colonizers. The same rhetoric is apparent in the official statement of the European Union's spokesperson for external affairs, according to which the European Union follows with great concern the latest developments in and around the Gaza Strip, where the ongoing escalation has already led to a number of casualties. It is again the abstract escalation rather than the Israeli army that has caused casualties. This passive wording is followed by an equation, as the European Union calls for maximum restraint on all sides in order to avoid a further escalation and further casualties. As the European Union shifts the responsibility to Palestinians, it remains unclear how exactly Palestinian children surviving under a siege and being bombarded should show maximum restraint, as Sven Koopmans and his colleagues demand. The core of the European Union's ideological stance becomes clear in the official statement that claims, while Israel has the right to protect its civilian population, everything must be done to prevent a broader conflict, which would first and foremost affect the civilian populations on both sides and result in further casualties and more suffering. The colony is regularly awarded a so-called right to exist, protect or defend itself. Palestinians are dehumanized in this discourse and their rights are ignored. The underlying cause of the violence, that is, the illegal occupation and blockade of the Gaza Strip, is not mentioned. Nor is the right of Palestinians to survive and defend themselves from Israeli brutality. Palestinians have the right to resist against the aggression of the occupation regime. Their right to armed struggle is even guaranteed under United Nations resolutions. The European Union discourse, however, is centred around the comfort of the coloniser. How exactly does the European Union imagine to prevent a broader conflict when Palestinians have been victims of an ongoing ethnic cleansing campaign and colonial violence for over seven decades? In fact, the EU-backed Israeli colony can only sustain its existence through a violently imposed apartheid regime and perpetual warfare. European Union officials blame Palestinians and condemn their reactions as terrorism. Dmytro Zantsev, the ambassador of the European Union to the Tel Aviv regime, wrote that the European Union unequivocally condemns the indiscriminate rocket fire by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad group. It is the reactions of Palestinian resistance that cause anxiety for the Israeli regime and thus discomfort for its European backers. It is thus unsurprising that Palestinian reactions to Israeli violence lead the EU to call for a sustainable situation in the Gaza Strip and evoke the myth of the peace process. Calls for ceasefire emerge as reactions to Palestinian responses, while the Israeli seizure of the Gaza Strip is easily accepted as status quo. The political communication of the European Union in regard to Palestine bases itself on a recycling of the same old tropes from colonial archives. Through euphemisms and myths, the European Union has conducted propaganda work on behalf of the apartheid regime by rhetorically converting the colonial war against the Palestinians into an alleged diplomatic conflict and at times into a self-defense against terrorism, and by perpetuating to its Western audiences the illusion that there is an imaginary peace process while openly backing Israeli crimes against innocent Palestinians. The deeply concerned bureaucratic elite in Brussels polices the behaviour of the victims of a colonial apartheid regime and condemns their acts of resistance, while romanticising state terrorism into self-defence. Whenever the next Israeli bombs fall onto the Gaza Strip and martyr Palestinians, European Union bureaucrats will already have their communication ready.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Praise be to God, Lord of the Worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household. And may God curse all their enemies. It is very nice to have you here, dear brothers and sisters. After 2 years, I am meeting some of you again in this Husseiniyah, one of the best meetings and one of the sweetest social interactions is the meeting held on the birth anniversary of Hazrat Zahra, salamullah alayha, which has been held annually with you dear ones. I think this meeting has been held for the past 35 years now. I wish to express my congratulations on the birth anniversary of the master of all women, Siddiqatul Tahira, Fatimatul Zahra, salamullah alayha, and also the birth anniversary of our magnanimous Imam. I wish to say a few things about Lady Zahra, peace be upon her, as a token of our respect. Then I will say a few sentences about eulogists and hay'ats, that is, groups of people who hold religious gatherings to remember and honour the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi. Of course, this day is Women's Day and Mother's Day as well.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A number of honorable women have complained that we should dedicate this day to just women. They are right, but this is a deep-rooted, long-standing meeting, and it cannot be underestimated. We should also set a day for meeting with just women as well, God willing. Our language and words are too limited and incomplete to describe the great status of the Immaculate Zahra, the Pure Lady. The Holy Quran and reliable traditions have spoken about this great personality. There are eulogies about her in such sources, but they require deliberation and thinking due to our limited minds for us to be able to understand them. This tradition that our magnanimous Imam Khomeini once narrated, that the angel Gabriel would descend upon Lady Zahra after the demise of the Holy Prophet, is a correct narration. When we looked at the source and documentation for this tradition, we saw that it was completely reliable. There is no doubt that Gabriel used to visit her. It has been related, when Gabriel would come to see her, he would condole her for the death of her father, comfort her, tell her about her father, where he was and how he was in Barzakh, purgatory. Gabriel would inform Fatimah al-Zahra about the Prophet's position with God the Merciful and his high status. He would tell her about the events that were to unfold for her children in the future.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.